This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 390 for August 25th of 2017. HCCI spells efficient engines. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai.
Mr. Vasilash.
How are you?
I'm doing good. You just got back into town, right?
Yeah, I was in Denver, and we'll be seeing a little of that Denver action a little later in the show. So you,
Volvo, we can let people know a little bit. Volvo
XC60.
XC60,
all new, and it's a good car. Good car.
Okay, so we'll talk more about that in the show. We got to let everybody know. Drew Winter from Ward's Auto is with us. Did you just get back from anywhere?
No.
I just came over to the studio.
You've been working, right?
Yes, I have been. I've been happy to be here for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I just, of course, I was not out of town, but Hyundai was holding an event for the new Sonata and updates that they've done. I shouldn't say the new Sonata, the significantly refreshed Sonata and refreshed Elantra. So we can talk a little bit about
The Elantra GT?
Yeah, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we can talk more about that later in the program as well. But what we should let everybody know is our special guest for today's show is Matthew Riley. He's the CEO and chief scientist of a company called Nautilus Engineering. And you guys think you've cracked the code on, okay, let me see if I get the HCCI, homogeneous charge combustion ignition.
Homogeneous charge compression ignition.
Compression ignition. Well, I was close.
But it's also HCI as well, homogeneous compression ignition. We're capable of doing both.
So what's the difference?
The difference is you won't have to have a turbocharger or supercharger for a stationary generator. You reduce costs.
And, of course, with HCCI, what you're talking about is making a gasoline engine behave like a diesel in the sense that you don't need spark plugs.
Correct. If you think about when you were a child, your parents would turn off the car, the old carbureted cars, and what would occur is you'd have the heat from the engine still sucking in, pulling in some gas from the carburetor, and that would occur in that instance.
And they'd keep chugging away, and they wouldn't turn away, it wouldn't turn off.
So fuel injection became the big thing to stop that, which was the wrong direction. We should have kept going down that path of trying to understand why it was doing it and try to harness it. Instead of running from it, we shouldn't have been scared of it. We should have tried to harness that energy. It's like what Meganock is today in engines, and you've seen a lot of
discussion. What's Meganock?
Meganock is where the oil and fuel get mixed, and your oil detonates with the fuel. It damages rings. There was just a huge article done about it with Bosch and somebody else, I
believe. Is this on diesel engines? Or
diesel and gasoline. They're having issues with downsizing engines with turbochargers and superchargers. But they'll figure it out eventually.
But you think that there should be a different architecture of the way the engine is, so perhaps these superchargers and turbochargers would not be necessary?
They're not actually necessary for everything. In automotive applications, I believe turbochargers probably are one of the best options for efficiency gains. You can control HCCI much more proficiently with a turbocharger for multiple ranges. You're able to have better performance levels because you have your volumetric deficiency in the engine. You know, different RPMs, you're going to be able to suck in less air and fuel. So that turbocharger helps balance that out.
Mm-hmm. So we're sort of assuming here that people know how this process works, and I suspect many don't. So could you sort of walk us through what it is you're talking about?
Well, for instance, increasing RPMs, you only have so much volume of air that you can draw through your valves into the cylinder. And when you're doing that, you want to make sure that higher RPMs, you have higher pressure outside of the engine's combustion chamber to push air and fuel into the chamber, or just air for that matter if you're doing direct injection or port fuel injection. There's a multitude of different ways to do that, but turbochargers will increase the amount of boost, so will superchargers, but superchargers will draw energy off the crank in order to run. Turbochargers draw their energy off the expanding gas in the exhaust, which is more proficient and better use of your heat energy that you have.
So the thing you have invented, which you brought models of, explain to us how that works.
Well, it's pretty simple. The technology, you'll look at the top of the piston, the primary piston, which is on top, you have a secondary portion of the piston, which is below. It's cooled from below with oil, shoots up underneath. The intake is here, and it sucks the air in across the top of the exhaust valve, exchanging the heat from the exhaust valve into the cylinder.
Here we got an animation of it running now.
You can see that when the compression stroke occurs, that's the intake stroke. There's the compression, ignition, ignition. It fires twice in the power stroke. The primary fires in order to cause the secondary to auto-ignite. It's just like a shotgun shell. So you have the primary spot that ignites, and then the secondary, the primary is opened into the secondary, causing a pressure propagation, which allows it to do homogeneous charge compression ignition or homogeneous compression ignition.
So you explained to me before the show started about taking a Dixie cup and gasoline and air and a hammer. Tell us about that. I mean, explain what we just...
Well, not a Dixie cup. It had to be a little steel,
whatever.
A steel cup or something like that.
But that's...
Tell us that,
right.
Tell us that
just
story.
Just a small one. You seal it up. You put a little gas in it, just a small amount. Shake it up. And you take a sledgehammer and hit it. It's going to explode because you're building that compression and heat.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the same type of technology applies to this. We all know that HCCI is very hard to control outside of a lab environment. Well, we've proved that you can control it outside of a lab environment by controlling the compression cycle. Having the compression to where you can ramp it up rapidly in just a particular small area allows you to create more pressure. More pressure equates what? Heat. When you have that mixture coming into the chamber along with trap volume, EGR gas, and you control that, that's all easier to control than just trying to control just the heat alone. Now you can control the compression, and we can also control the amount of pressure in the pre-chamber, which is your primary piston. We can control the pressure in there by a movable cylinder on top of the cylinder head, which would allow the amount of change. If you're, let's say, for instance, you're doing a higher RPM, you can actually run down that cylinder and increase the pressure in there even more rapidly for higher RPMs because you have less volumetric efficiency coming in. You're having less volume coming to the cylinder. So now you just push down and close down on that cylinder that we discussed earlier. And here you have a little cylinder piston on top that actually moves up and down so you can actually change the volume at demand.
But the result of all this is what you're talking about is being able to create very powerful compact engines, right?
Correct. I mean,
low cost, they're simpler, very efficient, and this is transferable to all kinds of power plants.
Correct. From stationary generators to agricultural, recreational, aquatic, aerospace, automotive, the applications are crazy good. It's a positive change for humanity, what we've done. And that's our objective and goal, is to stay positive.
So, Carmen, can we go back to that animation again? Because I want to especially make this clear to the audience, I hope. You've got, I don't know what you call it, like a thick button on top of the piston.
That's your primary source for causing auto-ignition. The cylinder raises the pressure as the piston's moving up. But when the primary piston strikes into the cylinder head, mind you, it never makes physical contact with the cylinder head. There's always a gap there.
Okay, but and in the cylinder head, as part of the combustion chamber, you've got a notch where that button that sits on top of the piston fits
into. It's received. But it doesn't make physical contact with it.
Right.
It's just enough to where it allows it to raise the pressure in that particular
area.
Super
high. Way higher than you'd get in the normal compression.
Twice what you normally have in normal compression. So it causes...
You're talking what, 20 to 1 kind of compression?
18 to 21 to 1, depending upon what your RPMs are.
Okay.
Because you have what's called bleed off between the cycles.
And then, I guess, to make room... you can't have valves in this head now. So you've got what looks like an L head.
Yeah, you could. But yes, it is more proficient to have the valves in the cylinder block.
So, I mean, this almost, I think people who know flathead V8s are going to be more familiar with this valve arrangement.
Yeah, the old Ford flathead V8.
Yeah. So, and that's the key, the button on the piston, the little notch in the cylinder head, and having the L valves. That's your secret sauce, as it were.
Correct. That is what allows you to do pre-ignition and control its timing of when that pre-ignition pressure is allowed to come out into the secondary and cause what's called pressure propagation. It's one pressure front with the heat equal in both, now coming out to the secondary with a higher heat and a higher pressure front, causing the secondary to auto-ignite.
Okay, so what's this do to emissions and fuel efficiency?
You get about a 20 to 30% fuel efficiency increase, which means better fuel economy. And even better yet, your emissions now drop down dramatically.
Why?
You're able to control your hydrocarbons, your COs. They're more balanced. You don't have lean, rich pockets everywhere. Like when you do direct injection, you'll wind up with lean, rich pockets because you can't mix the cylinder fast enough for a homogeneous charge. Homogeneous charge must be completely mixed. If it's not mixed, you have lean and rich ignition spots, and that causes your hydrocarbons or COs to raise or lower in particular areas, depending upon where it's rich and lean. But you also control your NOx emissions by keeping your temperature down. And with all the recent wonderful breakthroughs in catalytic converters, you can now control your hydrocarbons and COs to even a better level because you're not throwing the NOx emissions in there, creating more. You're using the catalytic converter to lower your hydrocarbons and COs.
And you're doing the mixture outside of the cylinder, unlike engines that we're familiar with now where the mixing is done in the cylinder.
We went back to the basics. The basics were carburetor, mixing outside of the chamber, sucking in, getting the heat from the manifold, the head, the exhaust, pulling it in from the exhaust valve. And if you never noticed, it would always just flutter like this, flutter real low RPM. Well, the reason it was fluttering is because several reasons. The main one was the EGR valve. Remember how EGR valves were set up? The diaphragm went straight into the intake manifold. So when the butterfly is closed sitting there, it's sucking the fuel in a lean cycle. But what happens to the EGR valve when it's doing that? Because it was an old mechanical system. So the EGR valve would sit there and flutter too, right? In comes the EGR gas right along with the fresh charge of fuel. Mixes up, goes into the chamber. There's your auto ignition event.
Hey, look, let's hold these thoughts. We got to take a quick break right now. I know Drew's got a question. We've got questions coming in from the audience. But before we get to all that, we've got to give a shout out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Okay, we're back talking HCCI, and Drew, you were just biting at the bit there to ask the question.
So when you have your power stroke, then you're able to squeeze a lot more energy with a power stroke by having like these two sort of combustion events that you're squeezing out all the energy from the fuel that way.
You're getting pretty close to 100% auto ignition event. HCCI is pretty much a 80 to 90 to even 100%, depending upon how well you control it, your auto-ignition event. In our situation, you got to remember, we're not causing the primary or the secondary to auto-ignite when it's drawing air from the intake valve across the exhaust valve. We're robbing the heat out of the exhaust valve and out of the exhaust system, bringing it in to preheat your intake cycle. So once you have it into chamber and you're compressing it and the valves are closed, you now have balanced temperature, so you've eliminated what? Your hot spots, you've controlled them. They're now balanced in temperature throughout the engine. You now control the amount of pressure coming up. We're at 9.5 to 1 in our compression ratio. So when you come up, you have that little primary piston that slams the pressure up 2 times of what it already is in the chamber. Doubling it, you're now 18.5 to 1, which is the required precise amount of pressure for HCCI events. As you go in higher RPMs, you have less time for the air to bleed between the primary and secondary, which also allows to raise the compression ratio in the primary. It's a rapid punch into the cylinder head. But keep in mind, it never makes physical contact with the cylinder head. It just has a small enough gap to where air can't bleed by fast enough. Now, if you have an HCCI event or a super knock event happen before top dead center in a conventional engine, we all know it destroys the engine, does a lot of damage to it. But if you're able to have a smaller little event occur, like we have here in the primary piston, before top dead center or at top dead center, That means after top dead center is where it's easiest to push down on the piston, which also means all your torque goes to the crank pushing down, and your fulcrum angle changes on the crank as well. Instead of pushing against the crank or down on it, you're not damaging it. You're not pushing it somewhere it can't go. But in this instance, now you're pushing after top dead center on the main event, which pushes down the piston much smoother in a more aggressive manner to the crank without damaging and destroying the engine.
So, and I feel like we need to explain another thing, too, is that there's probably a bunch of people out here saying, well, why are you even talking about internal combustion engines? We're all going to be driving electric cars in 5 or 10 years, right? And now, even the EPA says the vast majority of vehicles are going to be powered by internal combustion engines through 25, 30, or whatever. I know Toyota was even talking, they see some combustion engines out to 2050 or so. So you're still in the ballpark here talking about a super efficient gasoline engine.
Mm-hmm. So let's look at it from this perspective. Conventional engines today, let's just make a rough guess. Let's say a car costs $10,000. The engine in it is $1,000, transmission $600, so on. This is just for guesstimations for the general public. What if you can cut the cost of that engine in half? You no longer have to do all the direct injection or high-pressure fuel pumps unless you want to control better efficiency on the front end of the engine. You don't have to do ignition systems anymore as they are today. There's a whole new era opening up with this technology. Let me ask you something, because we talked about this earlier and you got an understanding of the technology. Do you comprehend the technology now? You understand it?
Not fully, no.
But you have a good grasp.
I got an idea. Yeah.
Decent grasp.
You grasp it.
Yeah.
What's your confidence level in this technology functioning? You've seen the video actually run and watched it perform. What's your level of confidence that we're going to achieve what we're doing?
I trust but would like to verify it.
Cool.
With a lot of testifying.
I like
very Reagan, very Reagan-esque.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I mean, so Matthew, there have been plenty of giant companies working on HCCI. And over the years, it's always coming, and it never arrives.
Boom.
Okay, so why should someone say Nautilus Engineering out of Wichita, Kansas has...
Yeah, Wichita, Kansas at that. That's even funnier, right?
Has nailed it.
I've had a lot of time to play with technology over the years, and I'm very well educated at what I do, but I stick to scientific facts first and foremost. You just pointed out something that was wonderful. Verify. My thought is you're all invited. You can come down to our offices, our research labs, and you can play with the technology up close and personal, video it, see it, and enjoy that it works. You can physically touch it, see it, smell it, hear it, and know what it's doing. We'll let you start it up, get a feel for it.
That sounds pretty good. We're going to have to take you up on that, I think. You already answered one of our viewers' questions. You don't have a high-pressure fuel system for this.
No, it's not necessary. But higher pressure fuel systems will increase efficiency because you have better atomization. Mm-hmm. And if you can get that atomization, the better you can mix it before it gets into the engine.
Like any engine.
Yeah, the better it performs.
Okay, Marcello De Facto wants to know, does it sound like a diesel engine?
Actually, no, it doesn't. You can hear it on our website. It's very smooth, like a conventional Briggs & Stratton engine. Hmm.
Doc Wolf wants to know, any thought of using camless valves, the free valve thing that Koros came up with?
Which is really cool stuff.
I shouldn't say Koros came up with it. Koros is using it.
Yeah, he's trying to perfect it to where it's more efficient. But
yeah.
Very cool stuff. Very nice. Hmm. Yeah, that's always an option. Why take away options or opportunities?
Doc Wolf also made the observation that your engine looks remarkably like a flathead.
Yes.
And he wants to know, a V8 HCCI engine. Any thoughts, anyone?
It's not necessary. You can do what you want with a four-cylinder and HCCI. You got to remember, conventional engines are flame propagation, We all know that flame propagation, you have to have a smaller circumference as the piston's moving up and down because you want to ignite that area and have that flame travel fast enough to where you don't burn it in the exhaust and create issues.
Okay, Armin wants to know, how do you keep carbon from building up inside the combustion chamber?
Well, I like that idea. You can see this very clearly since the valves are down.
Well, describe it because some people can't see what you got in your hands.
Well, the valves are down in the block, and since they are, you have nothing in the cylinder head other than the carved out piece of aluminum. And you can pull the head off in a matter of 3 to 5 minutes, spray it out with carb cleaner and vacuum it out, or spray it out with air hose, and it's quick and cleaned. You can do that every 20,000 miles if it makes you feel better.
Do you need to do it every 20,000?
I doubt that. I think probably every 30 to 35,000.
You'd have to pull the head. But you're,
the head is just basically a monolithic piece of...
It's a plate.
Correct.
It's a plate
It's a simple plate. Right, like the old flatheads. So it's easy and quick. But the thing of it is, when you're running HCCI or even HCI, you have less carbon buildup. Why? You're not putting as much fuel into the engine, which means you're putting less carbon into the engine that it's subject to. Am I correct? Anybody want to...
I'm not going to argue with you now when it comes to engine technology, but have you taken this to automakers, and what have they said?
They are very, very nice people. No, they really are. They've been very good to us. We even had a large global OEM give us a brand new engine off of their line to modify. Gave. I can't say which one because that's not appropriate. We agreed to keep that quiet until... someday we come into another agreement. But we are having a wonderful reception by the automotive industry.
What would the implications be for them in terms of their existing infrastructure, in terms of engine plants?
Their current architecture, you mean?
Mm-hmm.
It wouldn't change much there. Our objective and goal is to protect jobs even at the cost of profit. And that sounds bad to somebody that's looking to invest with us. But jobs are very important to us, and people's livelihoods, that's their job. You protect that, you have a better approach and a more positive, intelligent approach to dealing with reality of everyone's lives. You don't want to change somebody's life for worse. You want to make it better. And that's our goal.
So when do you think this could be in production?
It could hit production within 3 to 5 years easily. It just depends on...
Well, 3 years, no, right? Because 3 years, you'd already have an order, because it's going to take 3 years to get everything done.
So. Correct.
So you don't have any orders yet from anybody?
No, not at this time.
Okay. Who's your backers on this?
Ooh, that's a big question. We're very well-funded, but if I start talking about investors other than what are currently on the website... I think they wouldn't be very happy because everybody wants to wait and see.
Are there any big names on your website?
There's a few, yes.
Okay. Yeah.
There's a few. There's even bigger ones behind the scenes that are very helpful.
Okay, so you got the money to keep this thing going.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And we're always looking at options for increasing our speed to market more rapidly by more funding.
Mm-hmm.
The better the funding, obviously, the more rapid you hit market.
And you're looking at more of a licensing arrangements rather than building parts or engines yourself, correct?
Correct. We're looking at an extraordinarily low licensing fee to help automakers to deal with the transition and the changes. Like I said, our goal is to make sure the jobs are safe and secure.
Okay, we got three more questions just came in. Gene Lauft says, would this run better with a different blend of gasoline than we have right now? Would higher octane be better?
Actually, it runs really well on 85 and 87, so the cheaper stuff is functioning just fine. We haven't done the higher octanes yet. That's our next stage of testing, but we want to see where we're at, which one produces the best efficiency and emissions.
Skip wants to know, is there a specific transmission that better enables HCCI?
Not really. They're pretty much all the same.
Okay, and Marcello De Facto wrote back to say, what kind of viscosity oil will you be using in the engine?
040.
040. Mm-hmm. Why that? That's an interesting selection.
Well, it works real well for Porsche, and I love Porsche.
And could you turbocharge this engine?
Yes, you can easily turbocharge it, and you can multi-cylinder it. The only thing you don't want to do is you don't want to create what's called Siamese cylinders. Siamese cylinders make physical contact that creates a hot spot that you can't cool well enough. And even if it's a little hot spot, it can cause pre-ignition issues.
So it sounds like this engine loves iron blocks.
Yes. Iron, or you can do aluminum as well. Aluminum works quite well.
I was thinking from a cost standpoint.
And magnesium alloy, like is in BMW, they do really good work too.
Real good. Look, we're going to have to wrap up this segment, but Matthew Riley, thanks so much for coming on. Very interesting. Oh, we didn't even ask you about Mazda. Mazda just said they're going to make it work with spark plugs. But you're saying you don't need spark plugs.
We don't need spark plugs.
Real good. Well, thanks so much for coming by. Very interesting what you're doing here. We're going to have to keep track of how you guys go with your development because this could be a game changer if it works.
We believe it is.
And
Nautilus.
When I say works, I don't mean I believe you that this physically works. You just know it's so hard to change things in the automotive industry. And that's what I mean. Does it work from a business standpoint?
All you have to do is think positive, stay positive, and have a positive approach, and you'll achieve your goals. We're very goal-oriented. But I really appreciate you having us on the show today, and it's a pleasure talking to you, gentlemen. We really appreciate it.
Real good.
Thanks.
Don't go away, everybody. We got a lot more to talk about, but right now we're going to give a shout-out to our friends at Bridgestone.
Well, I think that's the first inventor I've talked to in so long that didn't have some sort of, involved software or something else,
Yeah, this is purely mechanical.
Yeah, something that was
and
mechanical.
And no exotic materials anything.
Yeah.
I love the idea.
Yeah.
But, what I like to point out, really only three engines have made it in the automotive industry. The gasoline engine, the diesel engine, and the Wankel engine. And some would argue the Wankel engine really didn't make it either.
Yeah.
So, and that's what I meant with my comment. It is so hard
to
get change in the automotive industry, even with a great idea.
Because and lots of times it's a great idea, but then productionizing it or emissions, which, killed the rotary and it killed the orbital and so many other great ideas. I mean,
it takes a long time.
It's hard.
And everyone's focused on batteries or maybe even fuel cells and that right now. So, but, hey, I hope they make it work. Mm-hmm. I think it'd be cool.
Well, I do. I think there is some room for more efficient internal combustion engines for a long time range extenders for battery cars or hybrids or whatever. I mean, I think there is room for a lot of these new types of ICE engines.
Yeah. Just think of those guys making all those complicated cylinder heads, though, and they just see that flat piece of the. All you got to do is just mill that section out, and well, we're done.
Yeah. Well, and somebody else mentioned about high-pressure injection systems. Well, they're so expensive. You start talking about all these, there's 25,000 PSI for a diesel engine, what that pump costs and that kind of stuff.
No, that's a great point. Most people don't realize the high cost of diesel engines is mainly the pump and injectors.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And the lines.
Yeah, and the plumbing. And he's got a simple idea.
I like it. I like it. Okay, anyway, it's that time of the show for Dr. Data.
All right, so this is going to be sort of topical, sort of what we've just been talking about. So, Carmen, please bring up the first slide. Okay, so
726.6 million.
And this is in December 2009. And next slide, please.
678.9. So, wait, what was the first number? 726.6.
Right.
And so now it's gone down.
It's lower.
It's lower.
600. Back to the second one. There we go. This week. Okay, this is as of this week. What could this be? What has dropped since 2009? And it's something very important, and it's something we've been basically talking about.
Fuel economy?
No.
No.
Gasoline usage? Fuel usage.
That's what I was saying. That's what I meant.
Million gallons, maybe?
I didn't want to put that. If I put what the measure was, you guys get it. Okay.
You get it. Okay.
Carmen, the payoff. The barrels of oil in the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. So basically, it began in December of 2009. Okay? So right now, so what it was that because of problems with things like hurricanes, they decided, gee whiz, we need to basically have oil in the United States, so in case we needed it or if there was another embargo. So right now we have 94 days of protection. Now there's some discussion of selling half of that off. So the question that I sort of wonder about is that, do you really want that in the bank, or do you want the money in the bank?
Yeah. Well, and then the other thing is, you know, you sell that much, then that is that going to decrease oil prices further? And then are you going to get the oil companies upset? Or you know, I mean, it's a political issue to me, purely political.
Well, you know, in 2009, we were still talking about peak oil. The world was running out of oil, price was going to go to $150 a barrel, and who knows what beyond that.
Now we're swimming in it.
And now we don't have that problem. So do you need a strategic reserve when we are awash in oil and natural gas?
I say yes.
Yeah, I agree with you, because the big fuel crises that we remember in the 70s, neither one was caused by a lack of fuel. It was caused by political issues, wars, whatever. So the world's getting more unstable. I think we need the insurance.
Mm-hmm. But, okay, moving right along from oil. So this is a certain interesting thing. So Volkswagen came out on Saturday and announced that they're going to be bringing back the microbus, but they're going to be bringing it back as the ID Buzz, an electric version, and here we have a picture of it on the screen. Now this is sort of interesting. If you think about it, they've been bringing this concept property around.
Oh my God, they've introduced this how many times?
For a number of years.
CES, and I thought they announced this at CES. They were going to make this electric and bring it out.
Well, and remember, they had another prototype a few years back too, and that it was really cool looking. But then they decided it was going to be too expensive.
Mm-hmm.
I forget what that was, but it was a microbus concept.
Yeah, no, it was a concept that they showed at the Detroit show, in fact.
So now there's, who knows who came up with these names, but then, so that's ID Buzz, and then they have the ID Cross, which is an SUV version of the thing. But so I got to ask you guys, okay, so we remember the microbus, right? But do young people remember the microbus, and is it going to resonate with them in a way that I think Volkswagen is hoping it'll resonate?
I think it'll resonate with them, but not for any nostalgic reason. To answer your question, no. The younger generation doesn't remember the microbuses. They all rusted out 25 years ago.
We have some pictures of them now.
But iconic design is iconic design, and that captures that transporter bus, the ID Buzz does.
Well, and the time may be coming back, too, just the utility of it. You know, basically a big box where you can carry a lot of people around. It's good for ride sharing.
That's a good point.
Okay, but everyone struggles with the notion of a minivan, right? Why would this?
Oh, I don't get the minivan out of that. No, I mean, I think that's the other thing. The microbus was, you know, a hippie van where you got with all your hippie friends and went to Woodstock or whatever.
Yeah, but to John's point, people don't remember that.
No, but that's, they'll create their, the millennials or the Generation Z will create their own new type of aesthetic or what is it, zeitgeist or whatever you want to say about it, because they'll create their own because, again, it has this basic utility and shareability and you know, you can kind of create a lifestyle around it or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great idea.
You know, to me, in a way, it's like the Scion XB, the first generation, which was actually designed more as a delivery vehicle in Japan than as a passenger vehicle. Yeah. But they brought it over here, and Gen Xers loved it. Why? Because it was almost anti-design. It was designed purely for functionality. And that was the whole design philosophy behind the original Volkswagen Transporter, the Bully, as they called it. Just push everything out, you know, make the most space-efficient vehicle possible. Don't even worry about styling. But they did it in a way that created iconic styling. And this ID Buzz goes right back to that.
Yeah.
And I think a young generation will love this vehicle.
So both of you give it big thumbs up.
Yeah.
So will young people buy Volkswagen products? We've talked over the months now about the black eye that they've had vis-a-vis diesel.
You know, my guess is the general public is only vaguely aware of this issue. In the U.S. Now, in Germany, it's become a big political issue. That might be different.
Right, yeah. And they don't want to become a diesel museum.
But here, my guess is the general public barely registers with them.
Yeah.
So I thought another interesting thing, speaking of the millennials and the generation whatever is...
Z.
Gen
Z.
What do you do after Z?
Start over again, like Henry Ford, I guess.
So Ford is getting ready to launch the new Expedition, and so they've done some research whereby they're trying to convince themselves probably that there's a big demand for these large vehicles, and so they sent out a news release, and the opening paragraph for opening sentences are, for many years, student debt, a tough job market, and tight lending standards were the bane of this generation's existence. But life is improving on those fronts, and kids are entering the picture. So basically, they make this argument that it's all good now, and they're having children. So I thought it was sort of interesting. So I looked, and it turns out that student debt as of the end of last year was $1.31 trillion.
Which means it's only gone up. Because I want to say, like, a year or two ago, it was a trillion.
Yeah. It went up $31 billion in the last quarter of 2016 alone. So, okay, so here's the thing. So basically, Ford is trying to make the argument that as you have younger people and they're having families, that they're all going to go out and buy larger sport utility vehicles rather than smaller and mid-sized sport utility vehicles, which we see booming like mad right now, okay? And they're saying, well, but... you know, the younger ones are moving out into the suburbs and they're having more kids and they need more room. I think that's wishful thinking.
Well, I would have felt a lot better if that study had been done by, you know, not an automaker with a big investment in big SUVs, you know. But I guess I have two opinions. First, in terms of student debt and things, most people don't go to college.
Right.
So they don't have student debt. They don't have much money either to buy a car. We've talked about before. A lot of people can't afford to buy new cars.
Certainly not a giant SUV.
Right. Yeah. It's $40,000, $50,000, $60,000. But I can see that in the U.S. or certain parts of the U.S., but I think from a global perspective where we have people in these mega cities and things, you know, that, I mean, it's purely a U.S. phenomenon, I think, that they're talking about. I see that a little bit. But I also think maybe we're talking about compact three-seat CUVs, things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But I chuckled when I saw it, but I thought, I'm not ready to swallow that whole.
Who's that press release written for? Is it for the people who are going to buy these things? Hey, you got a good job. Don't worry about that student
debt. You're becoming just like your parents.
Yeah. Well, that's basically what they're saying. They're like their parents. Yeah.
So I don't think it's written for a young generation. Is it written for the media? Listen to us hard-bit cynics.
Yes.
Sneering at this.
Yeah.
To me, this is like a Wall Street-aimed press release.
Yeah.
Hey, don't worry, Wall Street. Our stock is going to get better because, look, all these millennials are getting great jobs and their student debt's going away.
Well, you know, and this is sort of funny that so apparently that the debt, national debt, 10% of it, student loans. Okay, now the largest percentage, mortgage debt, 67%. Okay, national debt, 67%, mortgages. 10% student loans. Car loans are only 9%. So just think of all the cars out there, and student debt is greater than that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So no, look, some people have said, some smarter people than I have said, that the next economic crisis is going to be the student loan because that stuff's not getting paid off. Mm-hmm. People will pay off their car loans. People will either pay off their houses or walk away from them, and the banks take them back. But that student debt?
You can't run away from it. They won't let you.
Well, I know it, but they don't have the money to pay it off.
Oh, yeah.
It's a pipe dream to think this is going to get paid off.
Well, yeah. I mean, I was shocked to see, you know, some colleagues of mine who were in their 40s or 50s who were still paying off their college loans, you know?
Unreal.
And it's just, I've got my son's in graduate school now, and it's just the
I feel your pain.
Well, I'm lucky because he got a full scholarship. So, I mean, I feel like I hit the lottery, really. But it's phenomenally expensive to go to college for students these days.
What else you got, Gary?
Well, this is an interesting thing that, speaking of prices and things like that, according to the Black Book, which compilates data regarding things like used cars, the average used car lost 17% of its value in the last 12 months, dropping from 18.4 to 15.3. It's a big story that they did in Bloomberg on this subject. And so the average used car today depreciates nearly twice as fast as it did in 2014. And so the author of this piece, Kyle Stock, goes over the fact that, you know, we've had this continually growing demand for new cars.
Yeah.
You've got a whole bunch of cars coming in off of lease. And so suddenly we're swimming in the number of vehicles in that car manufacturers wanting to, you know, they're priming the pump with, you know, providing great incentives and things like that. And they're basically saying that, you know, the pool of used cars, it's just growing so enormously that people are losing the money. And the thing that really struck me is being interesting. You know, we've talked, you know, when we look at the monthly sales numbers and now the thing that OEM's pointing out about the reduction in fleet sales. And now, I don't know if this directly correlates, but according to the story that Avis Budget Group, okay, so fleet, right, Avis,
yeah,
its profit dropped 92% because it's beginning to lose the value of the cars that it has on the lot.
Right.
Because of, you know, so it has this inventory of vehicles. Hertz Global Holdings depreciation per vehicle is up 27% in the recent quarter, and it had 500,000 vehicles. So maybe it's not so much that the OEMs are not proactively reducing fleet sales. It's these guys going, holy moly, we can't afford to buy any more of these cars.
No, that's exactly what's going on, because I've been diving into these numbers. So fleet sales are down 7.5% so far this year in the U.S. Retail is down 2%. So, and it, to your point, I didn't know these Avis numbers, but I know Hertz last year had, well, I should say every year, Hertz's fleet of cars depreciates to the tune of $2 billion a year. So, yeah, all the daily rental companies got caught starting late last year. It really accelerated this year of having cars that they make money on selling. And that's where the daily rentals make their money. They don't make it renting the cars. They make it selling the cars.
That's just...
And they've lost so much that they've stopped buying as many cars as they have been. And that's where the real slowdown in the American market is coming from, is on the fleet side of the business. But guess what? It's not just the daily rentals. Commercial sales are down. Government sales are down, too.
So all this is not good news for the car industry.
Well, the good news is retail is not down as much as if you just look at the overall numbers. So that would show that the economy for new cars, at least, is healthier a little bit more than what's been reported.
Well, we all say, well, geez, we're still, even if sales do go down, we're still looking at, you know, 16 and a half, 17 or more million vehicle sales. But then everybody says it's okay, but then you see people pulling back and, you know, getting worried all over. So,
I suppose the real good news, though, is if you're in the market for a used car, it's probably a hell of a deal that you can get right now.
Well, I think if you're in the market for a new car, you're getting a very good deal for just about anything.
Okay, we got a lot more to talk about, but we got to take another quick break and give a shout out to our friends at Hyundai.
So, John, you just drove that car.
I did. And for all those who are listening to the audio podcast version of it, that was just an ad for the Hyundai Sonata because it doesn't say anything about it.
All right. So I've driven. Have you driven the car?
No.
The new Sonata. So I did previously. And it sort of reminds me of what they did for the last generation Camry when they redid it substantially. It was like every piece of sheet metal on the exterior except for the roof, they changed. And so tell us what you thought about the Sonata.
Look, it's a really good car. It's a quieter, much more solid-feeling car than the Sonata has been. And, you know, they keep making improvements to this thing. So they haven't been sitting on their hands for the last two generations. This new one is definitely a step up. It's now available with an 8-speed transmission as well. It's got a great, you know, ratio range to it and the like. Things like the on-center feel, you know, just the whole vehicle dynamics, a whole lot better. But to your point, Gary, they got their work cut out for them because that new Camry is a monster.
I was just going to say that because I just drove one last night, and I can't almost believe the words are leaving my lips, but wow, that car is something. The interior design's beautiful. The user experience is what we're testing it for now. Excellent in terms of pairing phones and all the electronics on it. And even the new 2.5-liter four-cylinder engine, then we had the hybrid in there. It's one of the best hybrids I've ever driven in terms of the way, you know, the smooth power and torque. The thing's gorgeous. I mean, I can't believe I got so excited over a Camry.
Mm-hmm. And I remember when we were driving the hybrid Camry, and you said, I don't understand why anyone would buy a Prius.
Yeah, because the hybrid version of the Camry about matches the hybrid Prius in fuel efficiency. I want to say it's 52 miles per gallon combined or something like that.
Yeah.
And it's like, why are you building a purpose-built hybrid when this bigger sedan with more power and a nicer car, really, all the way around, gets about the same kind of fuel economy?
Well, a Camry's quite a bit more expensive.
It is. But all I'm saying is,
but you get more car.
Oh, yeah.
Why don't
they
work this magic on the Corolla and have it get 50 or 60 miles to the gallon? Well, what do you need a Prius
for? Because they have
for?
A Prius.
Yeah,
All right. So, we've got to do two things. So we'll do one more thing about Hyundai, then we got to get to, we're going to go to Denver. So
what do we have to do about Hyundai?
Well, they announced the Santa Cruz.
Oh,
it's going to be coming. The pickup truck. So they did it as a concept car in Detroit.
Yeah. Here's a picture of it.
2015. And so now they've basically said, yes, we're going to bring this smaller pickup. Now, probably won't necessarily be like that. So
this looks awesome, by the way. I love the styling on this pickup. The only thing I'll say, though, is, and this is a concept, we'll see if they change it, the bed is too small.
Yeah.
This is a mistake that others have made in the past. They want nice, compact proportions. And you can't put skis or a mountain bike or anything in the back of the bed unless the tailgate's down. And screw that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So what do you think, Drew?
It's good looking. It's just this is a, well, every automaker that isn't into pickups wants to get in there because they don't have a lot of other areas to grow. It's worth a shot. It's a tough way to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even the Ridgeline, which is a a great vehicle, has not had a lot of success.
So Ridgeline sales through the first half were 18,596, which I guess is good for the
Ridgeline. We just did something in Autoline Daily about this. Ridgeline sales are up dramatically, but that's compared to a year ago when they were still ramping up.
Yeah.
But if you look at it, Tacoma's up, Colorado is up, Frontier is flat, but GMC Canyon down sharply. And I don't know if that is because of the Ridgeline. But, you know, think about it. Now, Santa Cruz is going to jump into the segment. Ford's going to be back with the Ranger in the segment. Now, the segment has grown, but I'm not sure it's grown enough to accommodate two more players.
Okay, but here's a question. Is it truly going to be a pickup truck a la a Canyon?
No, or a lifestyle.
Or is it, you know, so it'll be a Ridgeline-like structure, but smaller.
Well, and even the Ridgeline now, I think, has some wiggle. It can wiggle a little bit, right, between the bed and the cab?
Yeah, the bed and the cab are separate.
Okay, that's a key differentiator, which means you can actually have some loads in there.
Mm-hmm.
So if these lifestyle vehicles can't do it, I don't know. The market's changing. We'll see. I think they have to try it, but it's going to be tough.
See, I think all these millennials will buy that.
Expedition. Cool, always works. I take back what I said. I'm not sure that you can twist the cab and the bed separately. They have put a gasket there to delineate from a styling standpoint.
So you have a
separation.
Box and cab versus that sail panel they used to have on the side of the ridge line has gone away.
Right. Well, I know the ridge line's got a big box. I mean, you can put a lot of stuff.
Oh yeah. No,
I mean,
it can be a real pickup.
And it's a real pickup truck. Mm-hmm. So.
All right. Okay. All right. So now we're going to talk about a real new SUV and. I got to tell you, I was out in Denver this week. I had the opportunity to drive the new Volvo XC60, and man, I'll tell you, these guys are doing some extraordinary work. And I gotta believe that when the people in Dearborn see this, they're going to eat their livers and wish they never sold Volvo. So
you got this walk around. It's about 3 minutes long,
correct,
right?
Yeah.
So let's give the audience a little look at the new Volvo XC60.
Hi, we're in downtown Denver, where I've had the opportunity to spend the day driving this 2018 Volvo XC60, and I'm in the presence of Alex Trippi, who happens to be the guy who's in charge of this vehicle as the program manager. So, Alex, thank you for joining us.
Yes, of course. Thanks for coming.
All right. So, all new vehicle. Mm-hmm. So tell us what the thinking was behind this.
Sure. So the XC60, this is our second generation XC60, replacing one of our most successful models to date. This car is launching at the right time into a segment that's really on fire right now, and we're really confident that we've got the right product coming into this segment.
So the first XC60 came out in 2009.
Yep.
You guys started building momentum with that vehicle.
Yep.
Now here you're at a spot where the XC90 has been launched, and now we come out with the smaller brother of that.
Yeah.
Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, absolutely fair statement. So this car rides on the same platform and shares a lot in common with its big brother, the XC90. Mm-hmm. Certainly in a smaller package, a lot of attention has been paid to design and differentiating the design, so you'll notice this car has a much more sculpted body and a really athletic look to it.
Sure.
It rides on our SPA platform, our scalable platform architecture, and you know, as a result of that, we get so many benefits from drivability, comfort, and some design benefits too. So that SPA platform has given us the right proportions and allowed this car to really sit properly, have the right overhangs, and just you know, feel correct on the road.
So when you go at this as a clean sheet product, you begin to check the boxes off. So let's check some of these boxes off. So in terms of powertrain, what do we have under the hood of this car?
Yeah, so we've got three engines available on the XC60. A T5, which is our 250 horsepower turbocharged position, really will be our mainstream offer. It's really what's popular in the segment right now. This car we're looking at right here is a T6R design. So this has our 316 horsepower turbocharged and supercharged engine. Really nice choice for a customer who wants a bit more power. And then at the top of the range, we have our T8 twin-engine plug-in hybrid. So with the power of electrification, we've got 400 horsepower out of that engine, a 4.9-second 0-60, incredible efficiency, and we're so excited about it.
So basically, let's stick with that, the plug-in hybrid, just for a moment.
Yeah.
So you guys are the only people in this segment to have a vehicle of this size with a plug-in hybrid.
Yeah. Thank you for saying it. I didn't. We're the only plug-in hybrid available in this segment.
400 horsepower. I mean, it is a very nice vehicle to drive.
You can feel it, right?
You can feel it. Okay, so all-wheel drive, front drive, what do you have?
All-wheel drive is standard. On all XC60s for 2018. Yep.
That's pretty amazing in and of itself. So I see you have the Thor's hammer headlamps, which is a new favorite of the design staff. Tell us about how you think this model is going to compete in the market. What's it going to compete with, and how are you guys going to win?
Sure. So the segment is getting more crowded every day. You know, we really expect to compete against the other premium brands, so the Audi Q5, the Mercedes GLC, the BMW X3, and many more as new entrants are coming every day. But we are really confident we have a winning product here. You know, I like to describe this car as the best all-arounder. This is a car that you can live with 365 days a year. It delivers an engaging driving experience, no compromise to comfort, and it's also, in my opinion, spectacularly designed and really setting itself apart from everything in this segment, both the interior and exterior design.
Okay, great. Well, Alex Trippi, thanks for your time today,
and
congratulations on the car.
Thanks for coming out.
So that thing looks pretty good.
It's, you know, we didn't even talk about the interior. The interior of that vehicle is superb. I mean, they've got this piece of trim that goes across the IP, and it wraps around like a ribbon. And they do it in metal, and they do it in wood. And I mean, and it's real wood.
Either or.
Either or. Yeah. And I mean, and you touch the wood,
It's, and it feels like it's wood, not plastic.
Yeah, and apparently it was a really big engineering challenge to make this, you know, because it's about so wide, you know, which for those of you who are listening, this is about maybe 3-4 inches wide, and it just wraps like a piece of, it's just gorgeous. And,
well,
and,
here's what they did. I mean, you know, which we don't see a lot in the auto industry, but, you know, this automaker bought Volvo, and they said, we're going to spend money, we're going to hire the best designers, and we're going to let them do what they want to do. And that they hired their Robin Page, their top interior designers from Bentley. Mm-hmm. Okay, I mean, you know, they're beautiful. I just have not seen an automaker evolve like this in a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're just you're letting designers do what they want to do, and it's beautiful. And
only thing is, this is going to kill the XC90, which has already seen sales go up.
Well, you know, and the interesting thing about it is the fact that one of the points they made is that, so for example, the powertrains are the powertrains of the XC90. The technology and the other amenities.
It's
are
all basically the four-cylinder and different, yeah.
Right.
Different,
I mean, and they're just basically, and they're saying, well, you know, people who want a smaller vehicle, they shouldn't have to sacrifice anything, so we're going to provide it to them.
Well, here's the real reason. We can only afford one powertrain, right, and they're going to go into everything.
And this was part of their brilliance, too. They had to save money someplace, so they came out with one engine architecture, but then they one version is turbocharged, one supercharged, then the other is hybrid, and they did a great job on that.
It's a smart strategy.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
no, I'm not berating them.
They spent a ton of money, and they're getting away with it. I mean, you know. It's, mm-hmm. But you know who's going to buy? No, who's going to say the XC90? It's all those millennials coming now from
that's right.
Ford.
Yeah.
Well, hey, we've got a few more questions here from the audience, so I'll throw this out to you guys. Mike at San Francisco is interested in Geely saying it wants Jeep. He says, "What if GM buys FCA and sells off everything else?"
What if we buy FCA and sell off? I mean, it's just like, I mean, it seems the same likelihood.
That's assuming you can sell off everything else.
Yeah.
Pay a bunch of money to get
Who
Jeep.
Who would they sell it? I mean, yeah. I mean, you've got, No.
Well, actually, when you think about it, that's what happened when Chrysler bought American Motors. They kept Jeep and threw the rest
of
it.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
I mean, it took a couple of years, but that's what happened.
I think they looked at that during the recession, right? I mean, they were trying to try to sell off Jeep as a separate thing, and then you have to. But it's all Chrysler or FCA still is a lot of it's all engineering and plants and everything else. You can't just break up and sell it, I don't think, very easily. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, nothing's going to be easier. It would have been done. Jeffrey Rainey says, "Would there be a place for a Peugeot 208 hatchback in the U.S.?"
Didn't they try that already?
Not Peugeot. Peugeot's been out of the American market.
Well,
for a long
I guess haven't we seen that before? Something like the
look, hatches are getting popular again a little bit. So I don't think you could. Yeah, would there be some hardcore enthusiasts, or even maybe not so hardcore? Would there be enthusiasts who would like a 208 hatch? Yes, they would.
So I think what will happen is, so we talked about when we had Joanne Mueller on the show last week, and we were talking to her, and she was we were talking about the PSA return to the U.S. market. So I could see them bringing in a big sedan and then bringing in something like that.
Yeah.
But I thought, and we were talking about this, and this just came up, that how the, what is the app that they're going to be using?
For Peugeot, PSA, Free to Move.
Free to Move. And so Joanne said, well, gee whiz, maybe Google will do something like that. Well, it just so happens that this week, Google announced, if you live in a country where French startup Blah Blah Car operates, you can now open the Blah Blah Car app and book a ride straight from Google Maps. So Google's got it.
There's step one.
So
step two will be Uber and Lyft.
Well, they already have Uber. Oh, so oh, they've they? Got, yeah, that's okay. Part of the thing. And so basically what it is that if you were to book a Blah Blah Car ride through the Google, that Blah Blah Car pays Google, you know, some small payment. But the point is that, you know, is this going to work for PSA? I mean, now that you got Google going after them.
Yeah, boy, that's going to be tough.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to be real tough.
So,
because, yeah, the free to move thing aggregates
right. Everything,
and it sounds like Uber or Google's doing the exact same thing.
So, Larry Dominique's job just got that much harder.
Right. Okay, our work wants to know, why did Ford drop the Taurus in the 2000s? Because remember, they dropped it, and then they brought it back.
But didn't they just drop the name?
Yeah, I think they just dropped the name.
And
they changed the
name to some F beginning.
Oh. Yeah, because then that was when Mullally came in, and he said, why the heck did they get rid of this name, right?
Right.
And then, so I think it was, I think the car was there, but they changed.
No, I can tell you what happened is it became a fleet car, and they weren't making any money on it.
Yeah.
And they went, why are we going to invest in this car? We're not making any money on it. So they dropped it, and then Mullally came back and said, where's the Taurus?
Okay.
Or didn't Mullally came to the company and said, where's the Taurus? You got to bring that back. Everybody knows the Taurus. So
I think they're going to drop it again. Okay, so here's a case where Mullally wasn't the visionary that he generally has been. He thought the Taurus would be successful.
Yeah.
Well, maybe it's the car they put the name on.
Well, that
too.
Could be that.
I don't know. They got a lot of publicity out of it anyway.
They did.
And
they
we're
did.
Still talking about it.
Yeah. And Mullally's genius was really on managing the business, not necessarily coming up with the products that they needed.
Well, and I think maybe
that Volvo thing.
Well, but there was, you know, a moment, too, where he kind of reaffirmed, I mean, some of the corporate culture that, unlike some of these CEOs said, you don't know anything. I'm going to change everything and do it right. You know, I think maybe he reaffirmed some of the things that they did in the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Said we're going to try to resurrect them.
Well, look, we got to wrap this show up right now, but Drew Winter, thanks so much for coming by, man.
This is fun. Really
good having you here. And this HDCI stuff, I hope these guys succeed because I think that'd be a game changer. Up to a 30% improvement in fuel economy on an internal combustion engine, pretty good.
Well, you know, you talk to any ICE engine engineer, and they'll tell you that there's about 30% at least is waste. You know, I mean, any engine can still get 30% more efficient.
Yeah.
And this is one way to do it, and there's other ways, too. So it's possible, but...
And as you said, no software.
Yeah. I mean, so, but it's just, it's you know, it's a tough road getting into the auto industry and productionizing some.
Mm-hmm. Well, Gary, good show.
Yeah.
Let's do it again next week.
We'll try that.
As we always say.
All right.
Want to thank everybody out there for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems. And by Hyundai.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.